From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gralat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Sunday marks 25 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Celebrating the opening of the most vivid symbol of the Iron Curtain.
Mitchell Smith chairs OU's Department of International and Area Studies and directs the European Union Center. He was doing graduate work in Bonn when the wall came down on November 9, 1989.
The citizens themselves learned how truly rotten the East German regime was, and that's when I think it became clear that East German regime was unviable.
I'll also talk with our regular panelist, Rebecca Cruz.
Hospitals were actually taking blood, trying to get stores of blood because they were anticipating that they were going to need it.
Looking back at 25 years since the opening of the border between East and West. After this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat. A quarter of a century has passed since television networks around the world broadcast jubilant images from the area around Brandenburg Gate in Berlin.
Berlin's famous Freedom Bell rang out over the newly opened border.
I climbed over the wall and come and walk through the Brandenburg Gate.
As the 28-year-old cement partition between the eastern and western halves of the city opened, President George H.W. Bush famously said he would not dance on the wall.
I was moved, as you all were, by the pictures of Berliners from east and west standing atop the wall with chisels and hammers.
This half hour, we're going to talk about that moment 25 years ago with Mitchell Smith. He's the director of the University of Oklahoma's European Union Center and the chair of the Department of International and Area Studies. In 1989, he was a graduate student at Princeton University doing field research in the West German capital of Bonn. I'll also discuss German reunification and recovery with our regular panelist, Rebecca Cruz. She's now an expert on security studies and comparative politics, especially in southeastern and central Europe. But in the 1990s, she was a high school student participating in the Congress Bundestag Youth Exchange Program, living in Hamelin and traveling throughout both halves of the country. Rebecca Cruz, Mitchell Smith, thank you for being here with me today to talk about a very important event we're about to mark on Sunday, the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Cold War, November 9th, 1989. Many of us remember that like it was yesterday. But let's go back and refresh our memories and just think back about the historical moment when these East European countries began to claim their independence and move away from that Soviet bloc. So Mitchell, take us back to that day. What did we see happen on November 9th, 1989?
Well, what happened on that day was a surprise, actually, to many people, despite all of the events that happened leading up to that day. And this is the thing that I would emphasize that I think is one of the most fascinating dimensions of the entire event is how few experts and even people on the ground, people in West Berlin who watched East Germany, how surprised they were by the rapidity with which events unfolded, culminating in that date. There's a long series of events leading up to this point, which perhaps we can talk about. And even as those events were unfolding, when people were crossing borders, for example, leaving East Germany to cross into Hungary, where they were attending a music festival, and then crossing the Hungarian border and entering Austria and then West Germany and claiming West German citizenship. While that was going on, I think no observers saw precisely where this was heading, and that would culminate eventually in the fall of the wall.
Because if you think back to when things like this started to happen even in the 50s and 60s when there were uprisings, right, in Hungary and in Czechoslovakia back when it was one country, this was very quickly shut down by Soviet troops. And here in 1989, a whole different story. So not only were we not expecting to see it, we perhaps didn't expect to see the lack of heavy-handed response, right? Well, you were in Germany when this happened, weren't you? You were in Bonn, in Western Germany, when this happened. So what was it like on the ground there as you were experiencing it in real time?
Right. I was a graduate student early in my field research in Germany at the time. I was living in Bonn, which then was the capital, from January of 1989. Until November. And unfortunately, I was scheduled to leave just days before the wall fell, but the crumbling of the East German regime had already begun. I visited East Berlin in April of 1989. And again, there were no clear indications of what was happening. And this is true, again, of experts who studied the countries. Nobody was predicting the collapse of the East German regime at that time. I had the typical experience, the typical encounter with the East German Volkspolizei, the FOPOs as they were known, which means people's police and sounds very benign. And in fact, of course, they meddled constantly in people's lives and were not citizen friendly. But nonetheless, because of all these control mechanisms in place and because of the history that you've described in which resistance was very rapidly crushed, I think nobody expected that when there was the first surge of popular resistance that it would culminate in the fall of the wall. When it did happen, I was there, and what I remember very vividly on the German news is the fall of Erich Honecker, the longstanding leader of the East German regime and the general secretary of the East German Socialist Unity Party. That happened on October 18th. Egon Krenz was the person who took over. And I think, again, people observing the situation found this startling, but they did not see where it was leading. Krenz was actually a deputy of Honecker's and was not a credible political reform figure. So the idea of the regime fundamentally changing was something that, again, people had little faith in, but they also didn't see collapse coming.
Well, and I think that the response from the state, it was expected to be somewhat violent. You started seeing the demonstrations, particularly in Leipzig in October, the Monday demonstrations where citizens would gather at the church and then go out and protest. This turned into a mass movement as each week, as nothing happened or mass violence didn't happen, you had more and more people, hundreds of thousands of people taking to the streets. And we find out later that in Leipzig, the hospitals were actually taking blood, trying to get stores of blood because they were anticipating that they were going to need it.
So not only the actual occurrence itself being surprising, the lack of a heavy-handed response, a violent response being surprising, what happened next, obviously with all the whole slew of you know, claims on independence, but then the reunification of Germany. Now, was this also unexpected and you know, from what I recall, not terribly easy to do, but also something that seemed to be logical, right? That the East and West Germany would once again become a single country.
I think that's right. I think the unification itself was less of a surprise because by that point in time, by October of 1990, it was already apparent that the East German regime was no longer really viable economically, politically. But if we can go back to a minute to the moment of November 9th itself, I think a lot of the political and social realities in East Germany were not widely known. People knew, for example, that it was a fiction that the East German living standard was catching up to that in the West. People knew it, but they even people in the West who studied East Germany did not realize quite how far behind the West the East German society lagged, and also how deeply indebted the East German government was. So when Krenz came along and promised reforms, I think there were a lot of questions and people doubted that he was a reformer. This was somebody who had actually publicly supported the crackdown at Tiananmen Square. So no one believed his reformist credentials. And then when the Politburo decided, I believe it was just before, I think November 9th, November 8th actually, they decided to alter the rules to allow people to cross over to the West with permission. The Politburo spokesperson, Günter Schabowski, went on television and was asked, when does this go into effect? He had not been informed. The regime was crumbling. And he just said, as far as I know, immediately. And that's when people rushed to the wall. And so the fall of the wall itself was this sort of spontaneous event. But then things rapidly spiraled downward for the East German regime.
One of the slogans for the uprising was this idea that wir sind das Volk, we are the people, we have a say. And that quickly changed to wir sind ein Volk, we are a people, we are unified. And that moved them towards unification 10 months later, essentially.
I mean, it happened so quickly. I mean, the whole thing happened so quickly. And to think back myself, I mean, I wasn't in the country. And Rebecca, I'm going to get to you in a second and talk about your experience a few years later. But I remember so vividly watching these images and just all of the excitement, yes, but also tension, because there was just a real uncertainty. And I think your point, Mitchell, about how there was just a real lack of knowledge. I mean, we were learning so much for the first time. And seeing those East German, and particularly East Berliner, you know, residents coming through the wall. And when we talk about the fall of the wall, literally, I mean, people were just pushing it over and chopping it down. And so watching our you know, on our television screens, these walls coming down and people flooding through and the looks on their faces, it was so remarkable. It was so moving. And it was just that sense of what's going to happen next and a real just significant sense of uncertainty. Then 10 months later that they went from that moment to bringing two countries, disparate countries, very different, you know, experiences that they've had together, back together. I think it was just shocking in many, many ways. And it kept going and going and going.
I think Rebecca's point is really an important one, that moment when the crowd in the East went from chanting Wir sind das Volk to Wir sind ein Volk is really a crucial moment when and what had happened in that time was that the citizens themselves learned how truly rotten the East German regime was. That there was, you know, the security service reporting was you know, bordered on paranoia, or was actually of paranoid dimensions. How corrupt the regime was, and that's when I think it became clearly in a fairly short space of time that the East German regime was unviable. And of course, that ushered in the march toward unification very rapidly. After which, then Germany entered a very difficult period in which the costs of unification far exceeded anything that anybody had predicted. Helmut Kohl, in fact, got himself into a little bit of political trouble. He was sort of the father of unification and the German chancellor at the time. He, of course, was visionary in the sense that he seized this opportunity for unification and would not let it pass. But he did promise people blooming landscapes, and some of the costs of unification far exceeded anything that had been predicted, with the exception of a few members of the political opposition who said this is going to be far more costly than Helmut Kohl is telling us.
I'm talking with Rebecca Cruz and Mitchell Smith, the director of the University of Oklahoma's European Union Center and the chair of the Department of International and Area Studies. He was in the West German capital of Bonn 25 years ago when the Berlin Wall came down. We're on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU, and you can share your memories with us using the hashtag BerlinWall25. We'll talk more about some of the challenges of reunification and hear about the broader challenges of the end of communism across Europe right after this short break. I'm Suzette Gorlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I've been talking with University of Oklahoma International and Area Studies Chair and the Director of the European Union Center, Mitchell Smith, and our regular panelist, Rebecca Cruz, about the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall and the aftermath of communism's collapse in Eastern Europe. When we left off, Rebecca and Mitchell were saying that because German reunification happened so rapidly, the process wasn't very well thought out. Certain East German policies that benefited many members of society, like employment leave and childcare facilities, were eliminated in the rush to reunite the two Germanies. Fast forward a few years from 1989 to the mid-90s. So you're now in Germany, actually as a high school student, spending time in the country. What was that like in that period when they've kind of gotten over all the shock, perhaps, but yet it's still so difficult that moving forward, because, you know, that whole kind of two steps forward, one step back, you know, that there was all that excitement and energy, but then the real work began in terms of the costs of moving forward as a unified country.
Well, I went to Germany, part of Western Germany, the town of Hameln, in 1994. So I was 16 years old. My observations were perhaps not as academic as they later would become. But it was really remarkable to be there during that time. And I'm not sure that I fully understood everything that I was seeing. The classmates would talk about reunification. These were Western students, students from the West. We would have seminars about it. We even had a famous musician, a Wolf Biermann, that came and sang to our class, and I had no idea who this was, but apparently he had been one of the leaders of the movement, and so it was really an honor to get to hear from him. I did have the opportunity with my host family to go over to Eastern Germany, or what had been Eastern Germany. They had left East Berlin after the war, and so there was a connection there, and there were still a number of family members over there, and it was very powerful to go with them. We crossed over a couple times, and that was still a time where you could see the difference. You would go across the road. You could still see where the no man's land was. It was blank area. They still talked about landmines potentially being there. very bleak area that you crossed over. And my host mother and my host grandmother in particular, they cried every time. And even to this day, when I talk to them about reunification, they cry. But we went, we met with family, we talked about differences, and it was still very apparent to me that what I was experiencing in the western half of Germany, the beautiful house, the lovely BMW that we were driving in, which was pretty typical, that was not happening yet in the eastern side. I had the opportunity to go to Leipzig, Dresden, and Chemnitz, Karl Marxstadt at the time, and just still very beaten down, very dirty. Progress had not yet made it. But Berlin, you could start to see that there were some changes coming. And I had the opportunity to return in 1999 as well for a longer period of time. And you could see Berlin taking leaps and bounds. They used to call it the largest construction zone in the world because it was moving so quickly as it tore down old buildings and built up new ones.
My first trip to Eastern Germany was in 2002, and I still felt like you could see a difference between the two. So they've come a long way, but it did take some time. Well, we can't talk about this event without talking about other countries in the region. So Poland was obviously a major player in this as well, the Solidarity movement and the major leaders in Poland. You know, Czechoslovakia, as I mentioned before, was one country in the early 90s. It became two and engaged in what we know now as the Velvet Divorce, very quickly and easily separated into the Czech Republic and Slovakia. So Hungary, of course, and its developments. And then you go further southeast and perhaps you run some into some different experiences like in the former Yugoslavia, clearly that had some struggles, and Romania and Bulgaria. So let's make a distinction here because we can talk about Romania, for example, that had a little different experience. It's a little more violent in Romania, unlike what we saw in Czechoslovakia and other parts of Eastern Europe.
Yeah, I think I remember vividly. I was actually living in the UK at the time when the Romanian revolution was taking place. And I still to this day occasionally show students in my classes the video of Ceausescu's final public speech in which suddenly the crowd which begins to chant in support of demonstrations that were taking place in the city of Timișoara.
Doresc de asemenea să adresez mulțumiri inițiatorilor și organizatorilor acestei mare manifestări populare din București, considerând aceasta ca o
Ceausescu has a look of utter befuddlement on his face because he has never before experienced this anything but adulation from orchestrated adulation from the crowd.
No more, huh?
And he loses control of the situation, and you see this. You could see a video of this unfolding. And, of course, in Romania, events took an ugly turn and became violent, and there was some bloodshed in that case. And, of course, ultimately, Ceausescu and his wife, Elena, were executed.
Publicly. I mean, they were taken out into the public and executed, yeah. So a little different experience in that part of the world. Well, let's talk a little bit more about how, you know, what are all the implications of this experience for Eastern Europe, Central Europe, as we now often refer to this part of the world. What are the implications today? I mean, Germany stronger than ever, at least stronger, the strongest country in the European Union. But, you know, Poland, obviously a huge player. But again, some questionable countries too, like Romania and Bulgaria. But nonetheless, these countries have been integrated well into Europe, or at least much more so than I think any of us might have expected. NATO membership, European Union membership. So what are the implications of all of this in terms of how they're operating today?
Well, we almost forget, perhaps, that you talk about unification, that this was kind of a foregone conclusion after November 9th. But there were a lot of opponents outside of Germany to unification. Margaret Thatcher, quite famously, was against it because there was concerns that a unified Germany would act as it had before. And here we are some 25 years later. Germany is unified. And some would argue that they are incredibly powerful, though thankfully not in the same way that they were previously, or not exercising that in the same way.
And I think, you know, two critical implications. One is precisely that the rise and prominence of Germany in Europe. Clearly, unification marked a shift from an era in which France and Germany were sort of co-equals in the European community, the European Union, and that was no longer the case once Germany made it through the worst costs and tribulations of unification. And clearly, Germany is the leader in the EU today economically and politically. The other aspect that I would emphasize is that I think the European Union can claim perhaps as one of its greatest successes the transformation of those Central European and Baltic countries. Some people who are advocates of the powers of the European Union talk about its transformational power. I think we don't necessarily see a great deal of evidence of that transformational power outside that group of states, but that group of states really were transformed by their interaction with the European Union in very fundamental ways. And now we see today a situation in which the eastern border of the European Union is the Poland-Ukraine border. Poland very solidly incorporated into the European Union, and in fact, its prime minister was just selected by the heads of the governments of the other European Union countries as the president of the Council of Ministers, a very important position.
Well, both of these institutions, clearly the EU and NATO, and in some respects you might even say NATO first, that they became NATO members first and that helped open the door to European Union integration. But these two institutions, very critical in the development of these countries and moving them toward the West and toward Europe. But it wasn't just the European Union and NATO going to them. They were running away, clearly wanting to escape their previous experience and very much almost badgering European Union and NATO officials to that we want in. We want to be part of your neighborhood. We want, we don't want any more of that past. But that begs then the question of what's happening today. And Mitchell, you referred to the Polish-Ukrainian border. I mean, what's going on in Ukraine today and Russia's actions with Crimea and what's going on in eastern Ukraine. I mean, this has got a lot of people, Poland included, Germany, others in central eastern Europe, nervous about a new Cold War, a new standoff between East and West. I mean, what are we to expect going forward?
Well, I think you're absolutely right about all of this, and there is a new tension. I don't know if we could yet describe it as a new Cold War. I think we're still at a point where the tensions could possibly recede. But I would add that in addition to the turmoil that's taking place in Ukraine, and it persists, there were elections that just took place in the separatist regions of Ukraine in which clearly the Russian interest is to solidify the conflict, the tension between parts of eastern Ukraine or the breakaway districts of regions of eastern Ukraine from the rest of the country and to keep that conflict in the air. There's also been reports of sort of cross-border incursions of Secret Service agents in Estonia. And recently, NATO has intercepted a much larger than normal number of Russian fighter flights that fly close to the airspace of NATO countries.
Well, it's so interesting to look back at this event historically and remind ourselves of the very important nature of this event in 1989 and how we can't forget it's still relevant today and what's going on in that region today. It's still very much on the front pages and we need to learn from history, but we also need to be thinking about where this situation is going forward. So thank you both for being here and sharing your personal experiences and your background, your expertise on this subject. Thank you, Mitchell and Rebecca.
Thank you, Suzette.
Thank you. You've been listening to my conversation with Rebecca Cruz and University of Oklahoma European Union Center Director and International Area Studies Chair Mitchell Smith. You can watch the video Mitchell mentioned of Nicolae Ceaușescu's final speech in Bucharest, Romania, on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a joint project of OU's College of International Studies and KGOU. For our show's producer, Brian Hartzinski, our digital intern, Sarah Hurd, and our research fellow, Symphony Swift, I'm Suzette Berlot.